Gossip galore, seemingly ridiculous about Kate Middleton. Mystery over what type of cancer the King has. The self-inflicted death of Thomas Kingston. The absence of William from his godfather's funeral. Bad news, lending itself to speculation, has certainly come all at once for the royals. Ingrid Stewart has written a new book on the royal family, My Mother and I, The Inside Story of the King and the Late Queen. Ingrid is the editor-in-chief of Majesty magazine. She's long been a prominent writer on the royals and has been called the matriarch of royal reporting. There have been a dozen books from her, including The Queen's Speech, My Husband and I, and Prince Philip Revealed. Ingrid's also a regular television and radio commentator. Her late husband went to school with Prince Charles. Ingrid, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
The last time you made the top of the book charts was in 1988, you said on Twitter.
I did, yes. I had this very proudly framed little Sunday Times listing in my loo at home. And I looked at it and I thought, gosh, that's 1988. And that was the first book I ever wrote, which was about Diana.
Yeah. Well, before we get to the new book... And look, my first question is my longest one, Ingrid, if you'll bear with me. I mean, the situation of the royal family has been described in your tabloids in the last few days as precarious or fragile, the king ill, seeking solace in Greek orthodoxy, even though he's head of the Church of England. Princess Kate ill, of course, William not attending his godfather's funeral for unspecified reasons. Andrew inveigling himself back into the fold at the service for the late King Constantine, and the death of Thomas Kingston, which seemed to have been a shock. Is this a temporary bad period, all this stuff happening, or do you sense the ground shaking under the family a bit?
I think it's a temporary bad period because King Charles talked for a long time about wanting to slim down the monarchy, and he certainly has done that. He hadn't obviously expected all this to happen, but we don't know why William pulled out of King Constantine's memorial. It's very unusual. And he pulled out like 45 minutes before it was due to go. So one can only think it must have been a family emergency. But then they can't say that because then everyone will be thinking, oh, my goodness, something terrible's happened. So whatever they say is going to get people going. And, you know, we don't know why he pulled out, and we may never know, but I feel it's either something to do with the children or something to do with a family, you know, a very close family member, you know, probably something to do with Catherine.
Yes. Well, I suppose the principal concern is the health of the king, isn't it? That's front and centre right now.
He flew from Windsor. I presume he flew to Sandringham, where he seems to be spending a lot of time. So, but the thing is, I was surprised that he didn't meet some of the Greek royal family. He's very, very close to them. His father, Prince Philip, was very, very close to them. But obviously, his doctors have told him that he's just got to, keep meeting people to the bare minimum, and that's what he's doing. And they probably said no. Your Majesty, I really advise you not to meet anyone today. And he had to follow his doctor's orders. He doesn't look great, but I mean, nobody would look great if they're having treatment for cancer. But he seems very cheerful.
Just to set the scene with your book, I mean, we assume your contact book is formidable. Your writing spans eras. And in a previous era, you know, you might have been invited to Kensington Palace for a friendly chat with Diana or skiing. You were skiing with William and Harry. You kind of know them, we assume. You don't, obviously, you don't have to interview your keyboard, but you kind of know them. Would that be a fair description?
Well, I don't think they ever really want to consider a journalist a friend. And although I'm not a newspaper journalist particularly, I think it would be placing too much heaping too much honour on myself if I said I was a friend. I am. It's a symbiotic relationship. I'd love to say I was a close friend, and even the members of the royal family that I know quite well, I wouldn't say I was a close friend. I think I'm a useful friend.
It's elegantly described.
You
like Charles. That's apparent in this book from the get-go. And what's also apparent is how smart you think the Queen was. I mean, all the tributes to her, all focused on service and stalwart dedication. But the inference is that we underestimated maybe the unseen effects she had on the life of Britain and the Commonwealth. Would that be fair as well?
Yes, I think it would. I think that as she got older, people got to understand her a bit more. And I think she allowed the world to see a little bit more of her personality. You know, when she was the sort of young, beautiful queen, and not that either of you, I all remember that, but we didn't see much of this sort of wonderful, jokey, wisecracking in a way, or not quite, you know, older woman that we saw towards the end of her life. And I love that part of her. She seemed to be sort of in a way more honest. I remember talking to her about, well, obviously I love horses and I knew it was a very safe subject. So I talked to her about racing and we were talking about, you know, the racehorses that she'd been gifted, the horse that nearly won the Derby, and said, oh, I don't think that'll be happening. I don't think I'm going to be given a horse like that again. But you could feel that she was sort of kind of engaging more with people than she used to.
Yeah, that's interesting. But Charles was inevitably spoiled and self-entitled and sensitive. And the Queen didn't know what to make of him for quite a while as he grew up. Yeah?
No, she didn't. I think what she saw in Charles was a lot of herself, but not necessarily the character traits that she really liked. She saw his shyness. She saw his timidity. She saw his seriousness. And I think part of her wanted him to lighten up. But then she probably thought, well, but that's what I'm like. And it's my husband's that's the one that it lightens things up. And of course, Anne, who is 18 months younger than Charles, you know, was exactly like her father. And really, in a way, Charles was very like his mother.
Except that he's got a heck of a temper. We've seen his exasperation over fountain pens that fail to work. And in your book, his temper gets a lot worse than that. But then he swiftly reverts to being gracious and thoughtful again. So those seeds were sown in his childhood, or because the Queen's not like that, is she, or wasn't like that?
Well, no, I think it basically the temper comes from his grandfather, King George VI, who used to have these temper tantrums that they called gnashes. So they were illogical, but Charles gets these really bad tempers, but they're over very quickly. And I think people were quite shocked when they saw that video of him with the pen, when the pen leaked and the pen blodged and he wrote the wrong date. Yes. This was on his, you know, just after his mother had died. And, you know, he got really cross. And then again, at the coronation, you could see him. They arrived too early. And then he could see that he was getting really fraught. But it's really, he does occasionally throw things. I remember in Paul Burrell's book, he describes how Prince Charles hurled a book at him once, or a few books at him. And another one of Charles's chefs described to me how Charles screamed at him because he hadn't kept a certain rare fruit at the right temperature. But he said it was all over so quickly. But for that moment, it was quite scary. And he has this sort of high-pitched scream. But obviously, you and I would never experience that.
Ingrid Stewart is with us. My Mother and I, the inside story of the King and our late Queen. It's interesting, I asked our children who they like best out of the royals who've been around during their young lives, and they all said the Queen, then Kate, with the implication that it's the women of the family who kind of hold that public bond together. Would that be about right in your view?
Well, it was a very matriarchal sort of family, yes. It's always been the women that have been the strong ones. You look at the Queen Mother, and then you look at the Queen, and then you look at Princess Anne, and then you're looking at Kate. Yes, I think your children are absolutely right. I think it is the women that are the strong ones, and they kind of bind the whole thing together.
I have to ask you about some of the more sensational revelations in the book. I think we've seen one of them confirmed, as it were, on the series The Crown. Princess Diana almost called off her wedding to Charles, but her dad changed her mind, which is a bit like an impediment that might appear in a romance novel. I mean, Charles wouldn't dance with her one night, Ingrid.
Well, that was at Prince Andrew's 21st birthday party, which actually wasn't held on his birthday, but the end of, you know, a Royal Ascot. I think it was the beginning of Royal Ascot week, and Windsor Castle in those days was always full of people staying, and it was all very glamorous, and people, you know, would go for house parties for a week, and they actually had Elton John was the cabaret. Well, that's pretty cool. And Elton John does tell a wonderful story about how he actually danced rock and roll with the Queen, and he danced with Lady Diana, and he danced with Princess Anne, and he was very funny. He told about it on Graham Norton's show here, and he was wonderfully descriptive. But this is that same party, and Charles was doing his duty and dancing with everyone, and Diana just thought, well, you know, we're going to get married. Why isn't he dancing with me? And, you know, she was really upset, so she just sort of danced with herself. one of the members of staff was looking out of the window into the courtyard, and there was Diana sort of still dancing. This was sort of in the early hours of the morning, because the royals love to party and their parties go on late. And then she decided, I'm going home. I'm going back to see Daddy. And she got into her little mini metro and she drove to Althorp, where her father was. And she said, right, that's it. I'm not getting married. And he's, you know, spent the weekend talking her around. And also, I think a similar thing happened to Charles. You know, he suddenly realized, you know, what am I doing this for? I'm marrying someone who is, you know, merely a child. And I'm a bit of a child myself, too. How is this going to work?
Yes, nicely put. Yes, Diana looking exhausted and lost in her thoughts, yet still moving in slow rhythmic time to some tune in her head in the castle quadrangle. That, Ingrid, that also suggests a flair for drama, doesn't it? And there should maybe have been a big warning sign placed in front of Charles and the Queen, and one in front of Diana as well, as you're perhaps suggesting.
Well, Diana had her vision set on Charles from a long time before. The Queen said to her sister, Diana is one of us. I like those Spencer girls. And of course, to the Queen, you know, what could be better than your son marrying the daughter of a friend of yours? Because Diana's father was an equerry to the Queen's father, King George VI, and then he was equerry to the Queen. And they all loved him, and he used to go on their well, he certainly went on their first big foreign tour with them. And they, Johnny Spencer, they loved him. And so how nice that, and also, you know, it was aristocratic. He was Johnny Spencer, but he was also Lord Spencer. And, you know, he was going to inherit the title from his grandfather, and Diana was Lady Diana, so it couldn't have been better. So nobody really thought about this terribly young girl who was very naive, and nobody really thought what it was going to be like for her. Except the Queen did think, my goodness, she's so young and she's so naive. Maybe she'd be better for Andrew. But this was a bit of a joke, really. She didn't really mean it, but she thought in the grand scheme of things, Diana would have been better to marry my younger son rather than my eldest son.
And we can only imagine how that would have turned out, Ingrid.
Oh, my goodness, yes, exactly.
Diana has previously been quoted as saying that she loved her wedding day. So are the stories about her glancing at Camilla as she walked up the aisle or down the aisle, I forget which, are they all apocryphal, the tales we've been hearing over the years?
No, I think that is true. She did, because Diana was the sort of girl that, you know, she was always on the lookout. She and I think she was looking for Camilla, but I mean, that's a very feminine thing. You quite possibly would do that. You'd look for your husband's previous lovers. It's a sort of woman thing. I'm sure that you would never do anything like that, but it's a sort of girly thing. It's a slightly naive, but of course, Diana couldn't resist it. And Diana liked to know everything. So, yes, I think that story is absolutely true.
When you saw Diana in the flesh, you say, she looked as if she'd been dipped in honey. There wasn't an open pore on her body. She was flawless. That's something else that women would perhaps notice more than men. That's quite a statement.
I think so.
It's quite a statement, Ingrid.
Well, I've only ever met one other person that had skin like Diana, actually. And she used to work in a stable yard where I used to go. And I was just transfixed by this girl, not because of her beauty, but because she was flawless. Her skin was completely flawless. And Diana had the same skin. It was just extraordinary. And of course, she was a bit, you know, a bit sundown, not too much, not too little, just right. And she was wearing beautiful clothes and beautiful jewelry, not too much jewelry, just a little jewelry. And she just, you know, she had that film star quality. She was pure Hollywood in a way.
I think you got to know her a bit, just getting back to your acquaintance with them, because you ghost wrote Diana, The Last Word, which was the book by the princess's healer, Simone Simmons, who she confided in a lot and consulted with a lot. And that provided you with quite large insights, I think, didn't it?
Huge insights, yes. I wrote that book with Simone. And obviously, Simone knew Diana very, very well and had a very good insight into what she was like. And by writing that book, I mean, I wrote the book and Simone talked to me.
Right.
And I really got to understand Diana and the multi facets to her character. And I realized then that Diana was just different things to different people. She was whatever you wanted her to be. And one day she could be one thing, one day she could be another, which was made her endlessly intriguing and also very complex. And was, you know, far too much for a relatively young 30-year-old or 32-year-old, whatever Prince Charles was when he met her. He would never have really come across a woman like Diana before, who was so needy and so emotional and so basically, I suppose, emotionally unstable and desperate to be loved. He'd never come across anyone like that.
And being that kind of chameleon is often a recipe for disaster, isn't it, really?
I think so. I mean, Diana did say to me, you know, right at the end of her life, that she felt that had she and Charles met at another time, it would have worked, because she never stopped loving Charles. He was the one that got away, even through all her love affairs and her big affair with Hasnat Khan. It was Charles that she really wanted, because he was the father of her children and he was the one that got away. He was the one that could never love her, so she always wanted him.
God, it stayed a true love story, didn't it? That's interesting. In a sad way, of course. Other revelations in your book, Meghan Markle would often ring the Queen up because they enjoyed a special bond. That was a surprise to me. This is pre the interview with Oprah about a racist in the ranks, etc.
Yes, I think, I don't know that she necessarily rang the Queen from the US, but she, because she's American and because she was a very, you know, a strong person, she would pick up the phone where other people wouldn't dare to. I'd never dare pick up the phone to the Queen. But Meghan was that kind of person, so she just picked up the phone if she wanted to speak to the Queen. And the Queen, of course, dreaded these calls.
Nevertheless, the Queen liked her. And while we're on the topic of Meghan, you say, I think Meghan must have been incredibly envious and then jealous of Kate. I think you said that in an interview. So that is your instinct rather than anecdotage from one of your sources.
No, that's my instinct. And because if you looked at how close, you probably, I mean, us royal watchers, you noticed that how close Harry, Kate and William were before he met Meghan. And I know that all Harry's previous girlfriends, the first thing you would do, he'd take them to meet Kate, which was really charming. And they were very, very close. So, of course, Meghan's going to be jealous of Kate. Kate had the number one man. She had the number one house. She had the number one wardrobe. And she was incredibly beautiful and tall and athletic. And, I mean, Meghan is a very pretty woman, but she didn't really, go into the sphere of where Kate is.
Well, Harry, you speculate, may have been a little in love with Kate. In what sense?
I think more I don't think so physically in love with her, more emotionally in love with her, because, you know, Kate was his friend. And he always wanted a sister.
Mm.
He said to Diana, I don't want to be the youngest anymore. I want a sister. And Diana said, well, there is a problem. I'm not married at the moment, and I can't guarantee that I would have a little girl for you. But I think he always wanted a sister, and he saw Kate as that sister, the beautiful sister that he could really admire and look up to. So that must have really annoyed Meghan.
My mother and I, and we're talking with Ingrid Seward about her new book. But she could have had what Kate has, Meghan. I mean, albeit without children inheriting the throne. She could have charmed the world in a major way from within the family, and now she may get whatever she's seeking in a world that suits her better, but at a price. And many Americans seem to disapprove of her, along with many Brits. So that, at the moment, that doesn't seem to have turned out that beautifully.
No, I don't think it has. I think she's had a lot of very unkind criticism, but I think she's also asked for a lot of criticism. And I think the Queen really liked her at the beginning, but I think she was very disappointed by her towards the end of their time here, which was very brief. You know, when they decided to leave the royal family, the Queen was very, very disappointed.
Yeah.
And very saddened. And I think she then saw that you know, Harry was basically completely controlled by this woman. Because the Queen was very, very wise. She'd never say that, so I'm guessing. But I think that she thought that Meghan was a pretty tough lady, and Harry was completely in her thrall, I suppose is how you'd put it.
In her thrall. Do you foresee sadness? Might she leave Harry? What do you think when you speculate?
I don't think they'll ever leave each other. I think they're sort of codependent. And I think Harry is obsessed with Meghan in a way that, which is why I mentioned it, in a way that the Duke of Windsor was obsessed with Wallace Simpson. That kind of obsession that a man has for a woman. I don't think Harry will ever leave her. And I don't think she will leave Harry, because I think she needs Harry's status to make her status correct. I see them together always.
Okay. Well, you also have the odd insight into Harry. I mean, the last time you met him and chatted to him, you felt like his mother in a way, didn't you?
I'm probably a bit older than his mother, actually. But yes, I did. And because he certainly was really easy to chat to. And I was coming out of Kensington Palace. It was like a sort of journalist meeting. I was in the loo and I popped out of the loo. And there I walked straight into Harry on the stairs. And he said, oh, I like your tartan dress. And then he said, oh, yes, you're a friend of my godmother. And we started chatting. And I did feel quite motherly towards him, because he really did not want to walk up those stairs and meet all those journalists. The last thing in the world he wanted to do. And I felt sort of quite protective of him.
Why do you think that Harry, quote, and this is from an interview you gave, Harry spells danger for the king?
He worries what Harry will say and what Harry will do next. And I think he also worries for Harry. And of course, he doesn't want two warring brothers, you know, his children. But at the moment, there's nothing he can do about it. And I think he's got so much on his, you know, he's king, he's head of state, he's, you know, he's struggling with cancer. He's incredibly busy. I don't think worrying about Harry is high on his agenda at the moment.
It's not a recipe for recuperation, is it? What he's got on his plate. That's the thing.
No, I really think that Camilla would be saying to him, you know, whatever you do, you know, darling, please don't worry about Harry. It will sort itself out eventually, which it will, whatever way.
Fergie seems to have achieved a measure of rehabilitation and more centrality again within the family. You stayed with her once. You say her undoing was debt, and the debt resulted in large part from what, Ingrid?
I think she just, you know, from just enormous extravagance. Some people are very extravagant. And I think she just never thought about how much, you know, things cost. She just thought that this was the life she was going to have. And I think it probably, although I don't know, it probably was a problem she always had, this sort of spend, spend, spend. And, you know, they have this enormous house, you know, it's 30-roomed house with a, you know, a 48-acre garden. They've got a lot of stuff. They still live the high life.
Yeah, we read about that saga. So he was the Queen's favourite, but she came around to a better understanding of and more affection for Charles, getting back to the meat of your book. And she thought Camilla would be the making of him, and so it has proven.
Well, absolutely. I think the Queen, although the Queen wasn't in a position to accept Camilla socially or business-wise, she couldn't be seen to be condoning the relationship between her son and a married woman because she is head of the church. And also, you know, Charles was still married. So she couldn't be seen to condone the relationship, but she knew that Camilla was a good woman, and I think she felt, you know, she actually had great sympathy for the way Camilla was treated by the press and the way she was hounded. And she felt that Camilla's strength would be the making of her son, certainly the making of her son in his latter years, which is exactly what's happened.
It's an interesting contrast in your book between Charles's call for frugality and the slimmed-down monarchy now, and his attitude towards Andrew living in the rolling around the big house, and but his the contrast is with his own spendthrift days as a prince, because he would take, I'm reading in the book, a shooting party to Sandringham and have huge ferns transported from London to create an ambient theme. And surely, even in those days, Ingrid, this would have been seen as a giant waste of money.
Well, I think the Queen saw it as a giant waste of money. I don't think anyone else knew about it, apart from the people that were in the shooting party. I think it was very much organized by Michael Fawcett. He used to make these amazing sort of themed weekends, and Charles loved it. I mean, Charles, you know, he was brought up, you know, as the heir to the throne. And in the days when, you know, in the 50s, when the heir to the throne really meant something, and he was, of course, very spoiled, because it was yes, sir, no, sir. I mean, he actually had, you know, he was addressed as Your Royal Highness, Prince Charles, even when he was a teeny, teeny baby. Now, the royal family don't do that anymore, because, you know, but in those days they really did, and it was very much more reverential.
So can he have a good idea really now, although he's a clever man, of the zeitgeist, of the changing times, of what really to do to keep the monarchy front and centre in the affections of Brits? Because it must be hard with that upbringing to get a clear sense of the outside.
Aha, but then you have the real world in the shape of Camilla. This is where she's been so wonderful, I think, because she actually, he's influenced by her sort of normality. And she wasn't brought up like that. I'm not saying, you know, she had a really happy, very, I suppose, middle upper class upbringing in the UK. And, you know, but she knew what things cost, what, et cetera, et cetera. And I think she's brought Charles down to earth a bit. Doesn't mean he still doesn't like to live in a grand style, because he's always going to be like that.
What happened on the Balmoral estate once when the Queen arrived to find that Charles had stolen all her lights?
All right, that was, yes. Well, the Queen was not staying in the big house. She was staying in one of the, well, it's not a cottage, it's like a sort of six bedroom house. And Charles had been staying at Burke Hall, and he'd taken all the lamps from one house to Burke Hall because he really liked them. So when the Queen arrived in her house, there were no lamps, and she was furious. So instead of getting, you know, a member of staff, she jumped into her dilapidated old Range Rover and drove over to Burke Hall and took all the lights back again. And Prince Philip used to get very annoyed with Charles because he liked one kind of art and Charles liked the other. So after Philip had been staying, and then Charles came to stay, you know, in one of the houses on the estate. You know, when they didn't open the big house the whole time, they change all the pictures round. And Philip liked his pictures and Charles liked his pictures. So there was this constant sort of battle of tastes going on.
I'm reminded of the phrase, this is how the other half live. I mean,
Yeah, absolutely.
And Charles, did he really once pull a wash basin off the wall and smash it because he had lost a cufflink down the plug hole?
Well, I think he wanted, yeah, he did. Yes, he did. You can pull a wash basin off the wall if you're really strong. I think, I'm not sure that he actually pulled it off the wall, but he was desperate because he lost one of his cufflinks down the plug hole and he was doing everything he could to get it back. But in fact, he probably just asked, you know, his valet to just pull the wash basin down. And once when he was at Althorp, at Diana's house, they were staying there, I think it was when Rain and Diana's father were married. And Charles cannot sleep in a room with the windows closed. And the windows were sort of sealed shut like they are in hotels. So Charles just got, I don't know if he got a book or something a bit stronger and broke the window. He was so incensed by not getting any air that he broke the window. So he put his hand through and managed to open it.
Good Lord. Oh, I could try and psychoanalyze that a bit more, but I don't think I'm qualified. But that's quite extreme.
Well, it is, but yes, I mean, but we weren't brought up like Prince Charles, were we? Or King Charles.
I'll ask you the question I asked our children. Who's your favorite royal if you had to choose?
Well, I do like Charles. I find him really interesting. I've always liked him. So yes, he's my favorite. He's a multi-talented person. I love the fact that he is so literate. I love the fact that he delivers, you know, his speeches like a Shakespearean actor. And I love that he cares so much about the country, about the planet, and about all of us.
He does seem to care, that's right. Will, under his reign, though, however long it will prove to be, will the monarchy endure as the mighty presence in British life, or will it wither away in size and relevance like the European royal families have, although media seem belatedly to have rediscovered the ones in Denmark and Spain? The winds of change are blowing hard in the world now, aren't they? What do you think about that?
Do you know, I don't know. I don't actually know. I very much hope. I think that I don't think the monarchy will be abolished, but I think it will change because in order to remain relevant, it has to change. And Charles knows that, and William knows that even more. So I think it will change, and it will probably change hugely after Charles's demise, if you like. But I think he is between his mother and his son. He's going to try and keep things pretty much the same, but you know, to his own format.
So it's an interregnum, but it could also be the end of an era, couldn't it?
It could be the end of an era. Yes, absolutely, because then we'll have, you know, all being well, we don't, you know, we'll have a new young king with new young ideas, and that's how it should be.
Congratulations on the book, Ingrid, and its popularity as well. And thank you so much for giving us your time of a night in the UK.
Well, I've really enjoyed it, and I wish I was in New Zealand with you.
For the weather.
I just want to go there because I hear it's so beautiful.
And you hear correctly. Hey, thanks a lot, sir.
Thank you.
Lovely to talk to you.
A pleasure. Bye.